If you hire someone who doesn't have the requisite skill set to succeed in your building, whatever that is, you know, there's no reason to bring them in. And that's true whether you're a marketing firm, a sales culture, a tech firm. If you bring someone in who's super talented but doesn't fit your culture and does not have the ability to do what is most important within your culture, they're probably not going to be a fit.
Welcome to the Sidcast, the podcast where we sit down with a fascinating guest each week to hear their story, who they are, and how they got to be that way. My name is Sid Finkelstein, a professor at Dartmouth College, and your host and guide as we embark on a journey of learning, discovery, and good old-fashioned conversation. This has been some time for the world of professional sports, hasn't it? Remarkably, they keep on going and it looks generally pretty good, but there have been some big hiccups. But sports leagues seem to be getting through the COVID crisis. Of course, arenas and stadiums are empty. Some sports have gone into bubbles to compete, but the games have gone on, and actually it's much more than I ever thought would be the case. The league everyone's been watching is the National Football League, the NFL. There was a cluster of cases on the Tennessee Titans football team not that long ago, and a few others here and there. By the time you listen to this podcast, it's entirely possible there's going to be more. Who knows? But the NFL is really trying to do a tremendous effort in keeping COVID under control, and they're doing all sorts of things that are pretty clever. I thought I'd end up talking about COVID for a long time on today's podcast, but I only got to it towards the end because, well, you know, I just got so into my conversation with the Los Angeles Rams chief operating officer, Kevin Demoff. Kevin is actually a former student of mine at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. But more than that, he's really become a leader in the NFL. The football team he runs on a day-to-day basis has among the most diverse management teams in the league. And I doubt there are any teams that are pretty far ahead of them when it comes to sports analytics as well. And in fact, he and the LA Rams just completed a gigantic multi-billion dollar sports stadium and complex in LA, actually not far from LAX, the airport. Kevin was an ideal person to talk to learn about talent, the evaluation of talent, leadership, diversity, and managing your career, all among the topics that listeners on the Sidcast have come to expect. This episode actually runs a little longer than most because after really a full hour of conversation, I know we could have kept on going and maybe for another hour or two longer. It was interesting, and I think you're going to find that to be the case. Let me tell you a little bit about who Kevin Demoff is. He's in his 11th year as chief operating officer of the Rams and the NFL. He works directly for the owner, Stan Kroenke, and he's played a really outside role in the development of the organization after they moved from St. Louis, which is where the Rams were for a while, to Los Angeles in 2016. One of his watershed moments was hiring head coach Sean McVay, who became, upon his hiring, one of the youngest, if not the youngest, head coach in the history of the NFL. And that speaks to talent and risk-taking, which is what we talk about today as well. And it turns out that Sean McVay-led football team, the LA Rams, ended up in the Super Bowl not long after he was hired. Kevin and the Rams have been dedicated to extensive philanthropic activity around LA. And one thing he said when we talked about the move to LA was how incredibly large the talent pool in LA is, incredibly deep, and also incredibly diverse. Something he recognized and something he tapped into and has talked about in a lot of different places. In our conversation, we also talked about, really upfront, Kevin's dad, Marvin Demoff, who's one of the pioneers in the sports agent business, one of the very first. He represented John Elway, in fact, Dan Marino, which is kind of amazing. Some of that conversation reminded me of an earlier Sidcast episode where I had both Ron and Mark Shapiro, Mark Shapiro being the CEO of the Toronto Blue Jays, and Ron Shapiro, his dad, who also started as an attorney, as Marvin Demoff did, but became a sports agent. He started in Baltimore with the Orioles in baseball and then expanded from there. We talked a lot about talent. We talked a lot about assessing talent, both in the Rams football team, but also in management offices for the Rams as well. And even more generally, it's obvious to me that Kevin has thought long and hard about talent and thinking about talent, where to source talent, how to develop talent. And it was kind of intriguing to compare his notes and his thoughts in the football arena to my own in business and the Fortune 500 arena. I know you're going to really enjoy this episode of the Sidcast. It's one of the most fun ones I've done in some time. And so let's get right to it. Kevin Demoff on the Sidcast. Welcome to the Sidcast. It's Sid Finkelstein, and I'm here today with Kevin Demoff. Hey, Kevin.
How are you, Sid?
I'm good. Where are you talking to me from right now?
I am in our corporate headquarters in Agoura Hills, California.
Agoura Hills, you know, I lived in LA. I don't know if you knew that for 6 years before coming to Dartmouth.
I remember that vaguely.
Yeah, well, that's impressive you remember that. But regardless, we lived in Northridge and we're going to move to Agoura Hills, actually, or Calabasas, which are nice, nice neighborhoods. But rather than move there, we decided to move 3,000 miles east to New Hampshire.
So we have rolling hills in my office behind us. They look a little bit more barren than they do, I'm sure, in New Hampshire at this time of the fall. But
have you had fires near you, actually?
We have not had any near us this fall. This is an extremely fire-prone area, and one of the reasons ultimately we'll build a headquarters somewhere not in the middle of a fire zone.
And it's getting worse and worse. It's been an awful year, California, Oregon as well. I want to start by talking about your dad, Marvin Demoff, who I guess he was a public defender. He was an attorney who became a sports agent. And how did he make that transition? What happened that led A to B? This is not kind of obvious.
Yeah, so he was a public defender for many years in Los Angeles County. He had the, I would say, either good fortune or misfortune of representing a couple of athletes in their criminal endeavors. So he was actually doing well enough that they wanted to promote him to capital murder trials. And he thought that wasn't something he had wanted to do. He had represented a few athletes. They had asked him to help on their contracts after, I think, a successful defense. Mm-hmm. He thought that was interesting. And in the late 1970s, nobody was really doing sports agent work, sports lawyer work. So he took up that endeavor. And here we are 40 years later in a very popular industry. But he was one of the pioneers coming straight from being a public defender here in LA County.
Yeah, and it's kind of like a serendipity story. It's so interesting because I did a session with Mark Shapiro, who's the CEO of the Toronto Blue Jays. I did one last year in the Sidcast. Then this year, early on, I did another one, but with him and his dad, which maybe we'll do that with you guys one day. And his dad is Ron Shapiro, and he was one of the first sports agents in baseball. And I think probably a contemporary of your dad, I would guess.
A contemporary for sure. And when I listened to that Sidcast with Mark, I did find it very interesting, the parallels in our careers and in our universe. How both of us jump from growing up in the player representation side to the team side, which I think is an interesting idea. Certainly in my family, it makes me a traitor. I can't speak to Mark and, you know, in his family, what that's like.
Yeah, it's funny. So your dad, I was reading, represented John Elway. Is that right?
He did. His big break, I would say, in the 1983 draft, he represented both John Elway and Dan Marino. So those two players kind of put him on the map. And when they did the 30 for 30 on ESPN a couple of years ago about that draft and the quarterbacks taken, for anybody who watched that 30 for 30, he was the one who was reading the notes about the draft and kind of the whole 30 for 30 was based around. So that was an interesting year. I remember that draft. We used to watch the draft in my house. It was on a Thursday morning at 5 a.m. on the West Coast. And before it was the production it is today, you know, it was held at home and we would watch and have donuts. And it was actually very interesting this year doing the draft remotely from home where my kids would sit and watch. You know, we had this amazing spaceship. I had 9 monitors and people would come in to put backup generators in our house. It reminded me of my family watching the draft 30 something years ago in the basement. A little bit more technologically advanced, a different side, but it was fun to have your kids sit there and watch you pick and hear everything that went on.
Do you remember if Elway and Marino went 1-2 in that draft?
Elway went 1. I think Marino went 28. So
28.
28. My dad represented the guy who went 2nd overall was running back Kurt Warner from Penn State. And the original Kurt Warner with the C, not the one that everybody knows now with the K who starred for us at the Rams. But Kurt Warner was actually at our house that morning. So after he got picked, he and I went outside and shot baskets in the backyard for a long time. I don't remember much of the, you know, Dan Marino falling or knowing much about it, but it is fun to think about from now. I think my dad had 4 or 5 players in that draft and 3 of them became Hall of Famers. So it's a pretty good day in our household.
Wow, that's fantastic. I mean, what you just said already, it makes me think of 3 or 4 different avenues to go down around assessing talent and how a Dan Marino could be 28. And famously, Tom Brady is, 6th round or whatever it was. And there are plenty of other stories like that. But the one quick thing I want to ask you about is the NFL draft, how it's such a big production now and how it used to be. And so to me, it's like a really interesting idea of the NFL somehow realizing that here's an asset they have that they can monetize that no one ever thought about. What do you think about that? And are there other examples like that of assets that are kind of sitting there hiding in plain sight that can become this kind of really important brand building activity?
what's so unique about the NFL draft right now, and I would say it's the collision of what I believe are the two most popular sports in America, which is the NFL and college football. And it's the one time where they kind of overlap and come together. And you always see that a little bit in the NFL draft. The highest ratings are always from places like Austin, Texas, and Birmingham, Alabama, places that are not NFL hotbeds, they're college hotbeds. Right. And people want to go see that. But I think what has changed over time with the NFL draft is in a world that is based on content every day, from the end of the football season, so make that the Super Bowl, through April, most of the football content is about the draft. And that's the stories people are telling every day on ESPN and NFL Network and podcasts. And there's a whole cottage industry, and it's probably even bigger. It's probably an ecosystem now dedicated towards people who talk about the draft, to do these mock drafts. And that is really the driver. And so I think the NFL draft is the culmination of 3 months of people spending all this time. But it's really, you go back to normally all fall, people watching college football and wanting to know how those guys are picked. But what I think is fascinating about the draft, and you talk about the asset, is it hasn't really exploded in any other sport. There's a little bit of the NBA draft that has that. But NHL, you know, the NHL draft was just a couple of days ago, and I think you'd have to dig hard to find any news about that.
I missed that one, and I'm a big hockey fan.
And Major League Baseball draft, they try to make it bigger, and it just hasn't taken off. And I think that's because the pipeline from college football is so strong, mm-hmm. you know, and how people follow that. You know, but one of the big changes that's also happened in the NFL, not just in the explosion of people watching it, is the event itself, you know, which used to be in a ballroom, you know, at the Marriott Marquis, you know, in New York, and then it moved to Radio City and everybody thought that was great. And now it is an event that draws 1 million people a year in Nashville, and this year in supposedly Las Vegas, and next year in Cleveland. And so I think the NFL has figured out a way to make it really the peak of the offseason and the celebration. And I do think it's a great example, as you said, of finding assets that you have that are undervalued that people have interest in. And, you know, the one thing the NFL is great at, if there is something that people are interested in that can be monetized, eventually they will pull those dollars back to the NFL from other people, whether that was with ESPN previously or in other places or in smaller publications online. The NFL always finds a way to kind of recoup that and share it amongst the teams.
Yeah. So how does that actually work? Is it the NFL is an organization that's just well-run organization? What's the role of teams, people like yourself, in any of those types of decisions that the NFL does to look for new sources of monetization or new ideas to grow the game that's separate from how you run your team on a day-to-day basis?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, this really comes from the league itself. And, you know, the league is made up of a number of committees. So in this case, there's a Super Bowl and events committee that kind of oversees the draft as well. And like most things, probably happened by accident. In this case, if you look at the NFL moving around, Radio City Music Hall was booked for, I think Easter was really late 1 year. And so there was a musical pageant with the Rockettes at Radio City Music Hall that precluded the NFL from using Radio City. You know, so the idea became, okay, I think they wound up pushing the event back 2 weeks or something to May. But they decided they didn't want to be at the mercy of Radio City Music Hall and Madison Square Garden anymore. And maybe they should take the event on the road. So they did it in Chicago for 2 years. It was a big success. They wound up stretching it out over 3 days. And then, you know, after that, they said, what if we could take that to a number of cities? And in the NFL, a lot of teams bid on the Super Bowl. But there are some limitations on who can host the Super Bowl. You have to have a stadium of a certain size. You have to have enough hotel rooms. And certainly the weather truly is one of the biggest factors. We're not going to see a Super Bowl in Foxborough, you know, at any time soon. Maybe once, you know, for those in New England. We did it in New York and they avoided a massive snowstorm by a day. Mm-hmm. And I think the NFL realized that, you know, as a way to engage communities and as a free event, this was a great way to help cities. But one of the things they then do is they go to cities and say, okay, bid on this. And the cities put up all the money for the draft. So there are really no costs. So not only did the NFL increase engagement, but they took all the costs that they used to put into Radio City Music Hall and shifted that to cities that wanted to bid to host the draft. So next year in Cleveland, they're picking up the costs. 2022 in Las Vegas. And I think Kansas City is next. And so therefore, they found something that teams wanted to bid on, and cities and municipalities that couldn't get the Super Bowl that were looking for events wanted to bid on. And I think that really plays into a bigger long-term trend, in which is a lot of these cities, as they seek to grow convention business and hotel business and tourism taxes, you know, have all of these units that bid on events and give public subsidies to hosting that. So really, ultimately, they're transitioning tax dollars that are for convention centers, for hotel taxes, into that element. And it's been a useful way to tap into that. But I think it's one The NFL has figured out a way to do it. Now, ironically, we talk about hockey. Hockey had moved the draft around. They were the first to do it every year. They would move it from arena to arena. Just no one really paid attention. The NBA has kept it in Secaucus, I think, for the past few years. Baseball has now started to do it on Major League Baseball Network in their own studios. You know, even through that, the NFL had fallen into this rhythm the past few years of, okay, we're going to go to a city and make this a massive event. And then this year they brought it into the home and everybody loved it as well. This idea that you couldn't draft without all the resources from your team headquarters and satellite trucks and technology. And yet we were all able to draft from our home. And I think everybody on the team side will tell you it was better to be at home and to do that technology. And I think from the broadcast, it humanized coaches and GMs and players a lot more when people saw them in their home environments. You know, as everybody has gone through the past year of our kids wandering in on Zoom calls or important conference calls, you know, here you are in the NFL draft, coaches and GMs are about to pick and their kids come running into the room and, you know, are in the shot and are on the phone. So I think that brought the NFL back down to a level of humanity that we are living through. And that doesn't happen very often in our game.
Yeah, I think that's a generalized thing that's happened now with COVID. As you say, early on, there were some of these videos that went viral with somebody talking and the kid comes in, makes faces and runs out and all the rest. It's so interesting because we, in general, create this separation between our personal lives and our professional lives. And many people are taught that's what you should do, but we're actually, it turns out, to be human. And we are the same in many ways. We are the same person, whether we're home or we're at work. And so there's this artificial barrier, and there's reasons for it for a variety. Yeah, I could see some of the reasons, but the breakdown has actually been, it's been a welcome thing. There hasn't been all that many welcome things now, but that's one of them.
No, it certainly has been, although it is funny, and I'm sure you've heard the same stories. People whose spouses are not in the house all the time, when they come home and work, I've come to realize people don't necessarily love their spouse as much as they operate at work as they do at home. Or, you know, my daughter tells me I talk too loudly at work. You know, when you have that bad moment at work, or maybe when, you know, you're frustrated or stressed, and that comes out much differently than it does at home. Mm-hmm. You know, you learn more about your spouse and your family and other people. I do think, you know, as we all strive for that work-life balance, though, seeing people at home in their environments has helped, I think, people understand more the importance of that work-life balance. Although it's fascinating, and I'm sure you guys see this more as you study, it's pretty easy for me to say that now that I can come into the office every day and work. We are one of the few, if not the only, NFL teams that are majority female in terms of staff. And to see, you know, our working mothers have to balance life at home and life at work has certainly been eye-opening to me, even though I thought we were pretty good about boundaries and rules and giving them flexibility. I am in awe of what they pull off, and then certainly still seeking ways we can give them greater freedom now that you see this lens into their lives and on a daily basis.
Yeah, that's become something that I think has finally been recognized because it's right in front of us. And it's been really, really challenging. And there's studies that are suggesting this could really push back the career track of many women because you got to choose at some point when the kids can't go to school or daycare or what have you. And most people are going to choose their own family and their own kids. And most of the child rearing and home taking care of activities are things that women do more than men even today. So you're right about that. How did it end up that you have an organization's majority female?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think one of the things when we moved to Los Angeles, we had this unique opportunity, which is basically to build an organization from scratch. And we embraced the startup mentality. We probably had about 100 plus employees in St. Louis. When we came to Los Angeles, about 30 of them came with us, some by our choice, some by their choice. Mm-hmm. And so you're sitting here and you have to restock an organization on the fly, but you're in one of the most talent-rich environments in the United States. And one of the things that we really focus on as an organization is not hiring from within sports. For a lot of our positions, we look for people who love sports and are passionate about it, but come from other backgrounds and in other industries so that we can expand our scope, our horizon, and understanding, you know, of the world. And one of our first hires was female. And, you know, we have some just amazing women. And when you go into the process and say, you know, how can we grow? How can we understand, you know, that audience? And I think one of the things as a team, and it's probably no different than other companies, one of our biggest opportunities to expand our consumer base is females. Mm. And so having people who understood what that approach should look like to me was very valuable. And from that perspective, you know, we started out that way. And I think it's true, you know, and you hear this so much right now when you talk about people hiring for diversity or in different elements. Once you have people in senior leadership who are diverse, whether be that gender, be that racial, be that in, you know, LGBTQ, they are much more open to hiring people who are diverse underneath them. And so I think hiring begets hiring in terms of, you know, our leadership team is basically 50% female out of 12 people. And so therefore the people underneath them probably fall in that realm as well. And, you know, I think that was something that was important to me really as we built the team to make sure that it was highly female or at least balanced in the same way that our fan base truly should be. And it started from that strategic point. And I think we found some great women and they've hired some great women and we've hired some great men as well.
Yeah. We do a program at Tuck every year with a group called WISE, W-I-S-E, which you might be familiar with. And they're people from some of the sports teams that come, senior executives that are women, and from the leagues as well. And it's such a powerful group. It's among the most enjoyable that I get to teach in executive programs. And they're people from ESPN and sometimes even from some of the marketing firms associated, but mostly teams and every one of the top leagues, including not just leagues, but tennis and golf and other areas. It's something to see. And once we started doing that, it was a bit of an eye-opener for me. I don't know why I had such a narrow view, but I didn't realize that that was the case. But even today, probably the Rams, LA Rams, are an outlier. You might be the most diverse team in terms of leadership.
It was interesting. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal last year about the Eagles, who do an amazing job, and the number of women that they have. And they do. And I'm friends with a lot of the Eagles people. I love what they do. But our organization kind of looked and said, hey, we have just as many women. What about us? And we sent Stephanie Chang, who's our VP Special Projects. She went to WISE 2 years ago, I think, from here. We sent her off to Hanover, which was eye-opening for her in the fall because she grew up in Orange County and went to USC and has been in LA her whole life. So, you know, Hanover, and I think it was November, was starting to be on the chillier side for those of us who grew up in Southern California. But it is something, you know, I think leagues are certainly headed there and you see the balance, you know, at the NFL a little bit more, the NBA and across all leagues. I think people are starting to find it. We just need to find more women now to go run teams. I have no idea how long they'll tolerate me here, but, you know, maybe once I move on, my successor within our building could be female.
Are there owners that are women?
In the NFL, I would say there are no majority owners technically who bought the team who are women. However, you see Terry Pegula, who bought the Bills. Kim Pegula, his wife, essentially runs both the Sabres and the Bills. They own both of them. And she's really the driving force up there in Buffalo and, you know, a terrific woman to get to know. Dee Haslam at the Browns has taken a much more active role. You have Sheila Hamp and Martha Ford at the Lions. So I should say the Lions now. Sheila Hamp is the controlling owner. And I think you have a few others who in name are the controlling owners. But, you know, in terms of women who have purchased the teams outright, we aren't there yet. And hopefully that's another. Shad Khan in the NFL is the only person of color down in Jacksonville. So that's certainly a place we can improve upon long term.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're talking about talent. And I'm interested in drawing a connection between how you think about talent for leadership, management, executive functions in your team and talent on the field. And if there's any similarity there, of course, talent on the field, we'll talk about analytics. And there are so many ways to assess a potential NFL player. And maybe there are just as many ways to assess talent in a management suite, but we don't quite do it the same way. Does any of your learning from one side to the other kind of bleed over? I mean, how do you think about those two different types of talent pools?
I think there are some similarities and some differences, right? I mean, I think the hard part when you're talking about talent in the NFL, you're trying to assess 21 and 22-year-olds for what they're going to become, how they're going to develop mentally. And I will say most of the time you miss on a talent in the NFL through the draft, something else, you missed on the makeup of the player, their will, their drive, how much they love football, what kind of teammate they're going to be. It's not as if what you saw on film in college doesn't translate in the NFL. It's usually something that's missing in their makeup. And that's something our personnel staff, our general manager, Les Snead, has certainly delved into much more, you know, the emotional intelligence side and trying to understand, you know, these kids, how they'll handle stress, how they'll handle pressures. And so I think that is relevant to what you're going to see on the business side as well. The emotional intelligence, are people good teammates? What is their work ethic? What is their drive? Those are the same. It's just very different, pressure tested. And, you know, there are far better ways to course correct that, I think, and work, you know, than there are, you know, on the field. And I think to some degree, players either have it or they don't have it. And I think about We have a player this year, a six-rounder, Jordan Fuller, who we drafted from Ohio State, and he fell in the draft for, you know, he didn't run very fast at the combine. You know, he wasn't a flashy player, but he was one of 14 two-time captains at Ohio State in the history of the program. Got as decorated as a program had become. And the way people talked about him there was he was one of the greatest human beings who had ever come through their program. And that was really one of the reasons we drafted him in the sixth round. He might have been the same pick as Tom Brady. I think he was 199. He was definitely in the 190s. So there was a little bit of, I think Ohio State had some fun about that. But you know, he wound up starting for us, even in a shortened offseason without training camp. And a lot of it was his makeup, his command, and that really helped his ability. And I do think there are elements as we try to understand this, you know, and we do a lot of testing at the Rams in terms of how people handle stress, how they handle emotion, what the transition will look like, because we have found that is where we get guys wrong most of the time. When we have missed on players, and I think a player for us like Greg Robinson, who was an immense talent, taken number two overall in the draft in 2014, talented player, just it never clicked for him because of a lot of different reasons. You know, and that's probably something we could have found out had we done, you know, more homework. And so I think the NFL is a different animal because, and I think it gets back to what we were talking about initially when we're talking about the popularity of the NFL draft. So much of that popularity is around people watching these players play college football. Then they watch them go to the combine and work out on TV. And fans and commentators really base their decisions and their evaluations of those players around those aspects that they can see, but not by what they can't measure. That's talking to the coaches. That's talking to some of those other things. And really, you know, then there are some things like the Wonderlic, which usually becomes public, unfortunately for these players, which is an intelligence test given at the combine, which is not very indicative if you have a learning disability, if you don't do well on timed exams. It's not going to show up on their Wonderlic, you know, and one of the problems that you have with those exams, and you think about the Ryan Fitzpatrick, who quarterback for the Dolphins, who went to Harvard, or, you know, for those both Dartmouth people, whether it's a Jay Fiedler, they score really highly on the Wonderlic, mm-hmm. you know, and people associate, oh, they Ivy League players are very smart, they scored high. And so therefore they give the test validity because of that,
right?
Which they really shouldn't do. You know, those are some really false positives. And so I think when we evaluate players, where we are spending a lot of time on the analytics, some of it is on the performance side, but the majority, we will now not draft players if their profile educationally, psychologically, as a teammate leads into our analytics, which say that they are not likely to succeed at the next level.
And so, in fact, would you say that you focus more on the makeup or the mental or psychological side because, well, first, because you think or have seen it to be so important, but also because on the kind of more traditional physical dimensions, those are well known at this point, and most teams can do that?
You're not going to take a player who is tremendously bright and personable and a captain if they can't play, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I'd always say the cover charge to being drafted by the Rams is to be gifted physically and to make sure that you can fit into what our coaches expect from that position. And even there, we are trying to use analytics to get a better understanding of how these players will perform at the next level. Are there any telltale signs that you can derive from data? One of the things that we have become, I think if you look at our players the past few years, we are much lower on the 40-yard dash than maybe some other teams may be because we have not found any historical correlation between 40-yard dash and success, with the exception potentially of offensive linemen, which seems even odder because that's the position where people tend to discount it the most. Once we deem a player can play physically, the next element is diving into their background mm-hmm. to see whether they can succeed. And that's ultimately what we spend more time talking about and trying to decipher between player A or player B. And it's usually what tilts the scales to a different level. And I will say, for an example, this year we drafted a player in the second round, Van Jefferson, who was a receiver who had fallen a little bit in the draft because he didn't run the 40-yard dash of the combine because he had a broken foot. But at the Senior Bowl, where we can now track players with GPS measurements, he was actually the fastest GPS measured player at the Senior Bowl. But because he didn't run the 40, because people thought he would run slower, he was kind of knocked for speed. But his father played in the NFL for a long time and is now a coach at the New York Jets. And we thought he was the most polished receiver in terms of routes, understanding of defenses, offenses, and concepts. And sure enough, he came into our training camp and stepped in right away and did very well. some of the people he was compared with at that level in the draft, who are more physical specimens, have struggled for other teams to find the field for whatever reason. And look, four games into a rookie year does not a career make. Right. But I think that to us was the difference of understanding where the mental and the physical blend together versus just the physical traits. You know, so for us, I think usually the players who we have taken in the wrong positions that have not succeeded, usually we look back and it's not the physical traits we missed on. It's, you know, somewhat of the makeup. That is the difference maker, and probably what you put your thumb on the scale truly is making the difference right now. You know, and I think it's true for coaches. For Sean McVay, if you are not smart and detail oriented, you're not going to succeed in his offense, no matter how talented you are. No different than hiring into an organization. If you hire someone who doesn't have the requisite skill set to succeed in your building, whatever that is, you know, there's no reason to bring them in. And that's true whether you're a marketing firm, a sales culture, a tech firm. If you bring someone in who's super talented but doesn't fit your culture and does not have the ability to do what is most important within your culture, they're probably not going to be a fit.
Right. In different talent arenas, there's various screenings that take place. So, for example, if you take market for MBA graduates, well, if you went to a top 10 or 20 school, the criteria to get in is very, very difficult. The percentage of acceptances are very low, especially when you get to Stanford and Harvard, but Tuck as well, and lots of others. And so there's already been a really good screening mechanism so that you have tremendous confidence that this person, no matter who it is definitely above the bar. Are you getting a star or not? Requires more work. When you think about the NFL, if a player has gone to one of the premier college teams, would you say that the same type of thing has happened? And then by extension, how good is or how efficient is the market for finding talent when they didn't come through the traditional system, when they didn't play for Alabama and Ohio State and USC, et cetera?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the way I would relate it to, you know, business school would be, nobody would predetermine whether you would accept somebody at Tuck or another top business school or after they graduate based on necessarily where they went to college in the first place coming out of high school, right? And so many people have different elements. The screening process to go to college is based upon your high school film, your high school tape. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's indicative, sometimes it's not. We have not found from the recruiting systems that being a 5-star or 4-star in high school is an indicator of any type of success. And part of that's because players develop at different points physically. They have different backgrounds. They have different educational opportunities. It's where they're born and where they're seen. And the NFL has gotten a lot better at finding talent in different places right now than anywhere else. Does it help? Sure. But I don't think, you know, we have seen that players from, you know, larger Power 5 schools necessarily do better. It is somewhat of an indicator, but, you know, you could look at, you know, the best quarterbacks right now in the NFL. Patrick Mahomes went to Texas Tech, which I wouldn't consider to be a large school that is an indicator. You know, Lamar Jackson went to Louisville. Russell Wilson, you know, was benched basically at NC State for Mike Glennon, who's now a backup, then went to Wisconsin. You know, so I think if you're sitting there and saying, okay, those are the top players, Aaron Rodgers started at a junior college before going to Cal. So these guys grow and develop, you know, and it's such a formative time in their life going from 18 to 21. And it's different from a place like the NBA where people come straight from high school and have success. You know, the physical maturity, the skill set, even in baseball, you see that a little bit differently. So I think if you were to say right now, what top executives, what were they like as seniors in high school? You know, there's a lot of formative development that comes from college, your first job, an MBA program, ultimately to where you land. And look, that's a lot of the hit and miss of the NFL draft, right? That's why when you're picking 21 and 22 year olds, and no different than when we hire non-athletes out of college, some people who you hire, you think are going to be stars and they work, some people aren't. And, you know, it's fascinating as you see a millennial culture develop in terms of people who don't work in, you know, I'm not saying who aren't athletes, who come in a year or two, want to be promoted very quickly up the ladder in jobs, title, pay. You know, that sense of entitlement really doesn't apply to players, right? When we draft someone they know for 4 years, they're going to be a member of the Los Angeles Rams. Here's their salary, which is prescribed. And then they leave. it will be interesting over time. You know, I think the where they go to college has become less and less important. And one of, I think, the most interesting things about the NFL draft right now in terms of talent procurement is, you know, we become so much more sophisticated in the amount of film that we can watch from any school in the country, the amount of analytics we put in, the ability to meet with players and understand them better. But yet the number of draft picks has remained finite over time, still 255. So we scout more players, we have greater analysis, we have greater tools, yet the exact number of draft picks remains the same. So what happens then is you have a far better understanding of the players who don't get drafted. Mm-hmm. Typically in the NFL, you see right now, first round picks have about a 50% success rate. Second round picks, 40%, and it drops 30, 20, 10. Most rosters have a number of first rounders, and then usually the second highest data point is undrafted. And I think that's because we are getting better at evaluating players and tools and finding more people, but yet our number of draft picks has remained the same and finite. And so therefore, you're expanding your pool each year. There's also economic salary cap reasons probably for it. But I think that that's also true with what's happening outside, right? The number, you know, through all of the tools of technology on the internet and LinkedIn and everything else, where we can find talent across the globe is growing exponentially from where it used to be company-wise. And therefore, you're finding a lot of people who might be great fits in your organization that you normally wouldn't have found, which I think gets back to our earlier conversation about the way we hire at the Rams, which is we can go find really talented people who want to contribute in sports, who aren't in this ecosystem in a way that we probably couldn't have found them 10 years ago through technology, through LinkedIn, through headhunters. The world is a vastly different place. And, you know, as the talent pools grow in sports and in non-sports, you know, I think people are going to get better and better at growing in the pool. I don't know if we're going to get better at choosing talent.
Yeah, very interesting. And what you're talking about in that last comment, I call that an untapped talent pool, a talent pool that typically others are not looking at for whatever reason, historical reasons or what. And, you know, women in executive positions now a little bit more common, but probably still not that well distributed around the league. That would be a good example. I'll give you two others, one that you know extremely well, and then this one first, which is I've always thought that someone that finished first at anything, even if it's a school of 200 people in a state or a country that you don't even know exists or barely knows exists, there's something special about finishing first. It's just some added dimension. You know, if I was picking, this would be a big bias on my part of picking that number one person, no matter how small that circle was, that population was, over a number five at Harvard even, or a Dartmouth, even though, you know, the data is going to probably support the Harvard Dartmouth kind of elite type of person. So I think there's something really special about someone like that. And then the example that you know extremely well when it comes to untapped talent pools is Bill Walsh, which takes us way back to a project you actually did, believe it or not, for me when you were a student, which I ended up using in Superbosses, and I talk about it all the time. And you were the one who pointed it out to me and then did the research about Bill Walsh, former San Francisco 49er head coach, that created this tree of talent that I think to this day is still vastly greater in number in terms of success than any other head coach. And one dimension of that, and this is the untapped talent pool dimension, is African-American head coaches, which I want to ask you about. And Bill Walsh was maybe the first major reason why there were even any African-American head coaches, because of the work that he did and the opportunities that he created. And I think the numbers have gone down. I know there's a Rooney Rule. There's a lot of things going on. So let me ask you what you think about, maybe go back to the Bill Walsh story, and then also minority coaches, assistant coaches, because obviously today, with so much attention finally in the general population on Black Lives Matter and systemic racism, these are things that are starting to show up now and people are paying attention and asking, why is this?
Yeah. And so, you know, I remember the work we did on Bill Walsh. Well, I find it, I don't know if it's ironic, it's certainly coincidental that the game-changing hire that we made for the Rams was Sean McVay, whose grandfather was Bill Walsh's partner at the 49ers in building that dynasty. And the coach, when people ask me who Sean reminds me most of, was Bill Walsh.
Wow.
You know, in so many ways. And I think, you know, when you look at in 2018 and 2019, after Sean's success, the ongoing joke of anybody who knew Sean McVay got a coaching job, you know, some way, somehow, to the point where the Arizona Cardinals, when they hired Cliff Kingsbury, put in the press release that he was friends with Sean McVay. It really hit a new low of that. But what was so interesting about Sean, and bring back to Bill Walsh and where you see that influence on Sean, is Sean built an amazing coaching staff in his first year, despite being 30 years old. And, you know, one of them was a close friend, Matt LaFleur, who was his offensive coordinator, but didn't call plays. And after a year or success, first year of the offense, Tennessee Titans came calling. Mike Vrabel wanted to hire Matt LaFleur as his offensive coordinator. And we could have blocked that move given that it wasn't for a head coaching position. And Sean said, no, for Matt's growth, I want him to go call plays. Like we want, I'm not afraid of losing coaches to better opportunities. Better people will come in and fill that position. So Matt went to the Titans. A year later, he got hired as head coach of the Packers, where he's now off to the second best start in NFL history behind only George Seifert, who inherited Bill Walsh's tree. And then so Matt LaFleur becomes a head coach because of Sean's willingness to give him the opportunity that he did not have to give him. The person who steps up into Matt's place in our organization is Zach Taylor, a young coach who was an assistant for us. And after our Super Bowl run, Zach Taylor takes that position and becomes the head coach of the Cincinnati Bengals.
Wow.
So within 2 years of Sean McVay being hired as the youngest head coach in NFL history, he already has two head coaches from under his tree, both of whom got their jobs because, like Bill Walsh, Sean was willing to buck current NFL trends and allow his people to interview for jobs that he could block. The crazy part, when you hire NFL coaches and you look at the data, there is not any subset that does better than anything else. You can look at coaches who had already been hired and been fired, coaches who came from college, coaches who were on the offensive side of the ball, coaches who were on the defensive side of the ball, coaches who were coordinators. There is no difference in the data in how coaches perform based on their background. You know, so when we were going through our hiring process in 2017, you know, we had a very wide-ranging search. The one place you could look at and say, you know, the data was a little bit more fuzzy was on young coaches. The average numbers were the same. But what was true was they were on the extremes. If you got a young coach right, it was a home run and they were likely to be a Hall of Famer. If you got it wrong, they were likely to be epic failures. So the young coaches, you know, when you saw it, whether it was Bill Walsh, John Madden, Chuck Knoll, Mike Tomlin.
Wow, legendary coaches.
John Gruden were great. On the flip side, you had Lane Kiffin and Raheem Morris and someone we know and love at Dartmouth, Dave Shula, who's actually his son coaches for us here at the Rams, who's now back at Dartmouth coaching, you know, with Buddy. But they were on the historically terrible. Now it averaged out to right in the middle where everybody else goes. But when you're hiring an NFL head coach, and I'd have to update this about a year or two ago when it was Sean, the average tenure was 3 years and the winning percentage was about 40. So, and that was true no matter what you did. And so I think that ultimately gets to the second point of, you know, in terms of the pipeline for minority coaches, are we giving them the opportunities to be promoted? Are we putting them into the right places? And I think the real emphasis right now is on, you know, so many coaches right now are coming from the offensive side of the ball. And that has been, for better or for worse, a historically wider coaching pool than diverse. Historically, diverse coaching pool tend to be more on the defensive side of the ball. And the big push right now in the NFL is, how do we change that? How do we make sure that that can move in a different direction and provide that pipeline? And then the NFL has made a bunch of rule changes to try to say, how do we move forward in blocking? So now you can't block promotions in anywhere in the assistant coaching pool. And that's really designed, you know, somewhat to help people across the board, but also to help minorities. Because when you have a good minority, people tend to not necessarily let them advance. You know, they want them to stay on their staff. And that's not because they're a minority. That's just the way the NFL has gone in the past few years. The people are very defensive of their coaching staffs and allowing them those opportunities. And, you know, you like to see it change and get better. Now, I think one thing that is great to see is that the college ranks, you're starting to see a little bit more turnover in terms of minorities. Here in the Pac-12, I think half of the coaches now, or close to them, are minorities. You know, and look, it ebbs and flows. Someone like David Shaw, who's at Stanford, you know, who has Wall Street roots through Gruden and everybody else, he would be one of the most coveted coaches on the market if he were to leave Stanford. He's got a great job. When we made our coaching switch in 2016, one of the reasons we did it with 3 weeks left in the year was, you know, I remember David Shaw, agent, was a friend of mine, said David would never talk to a team that had a sitting head coach. So my first call after we made a coaching change was to David Shaw and his agent to say, will you come here? That was our first target. And we couldn't get him to budge or even consider it. You know, but one of the things you see, you want to have the success is, you know, there was a study, I think, in The Athletic last week that minority head coaches have more minorities working underneath them on the coaching tree. And similar to what we were talking about earlier, diverse people tend to hire, you know, be more open-minded. Gender, you know, female leaders are more open-minded, hire women. What we need to make sure is that those minority coaches have success and wind up in places that are more prone to success. And therefore, you can grow that pool and see that. And there are ebbs and flows. You know, 2 years ago, I think there were 8 head coaches. Unfortunately, you know, what you saw was those coaches not get a ton of opportunity in Denver. Vance Joseph lasted 1.5 years. Steve Wilks in Arizona lasted 1 year. You know, whether that was fair or unfair, you know, I think comes into play. But the other thing that we need to do in the NFL, we are bad at developing head coaches. When you look at the turnover in the NFL in head coaches, we are terrible at hiring. Like any other industry, if you said you had a less than 50% hit rate in hiring CEOs, if you were a headhunter firm, you'd be fired. Right. And so I think one of the problems, and I think this is where I think it's a struggle when you look at minorities, since we're not good at it, it doesn't seem right that minorities are not getting the same opportunities as non-minorities. Mm. Right. Given that it's not as if you can point to any evidence to say that we're good at hiring. I think that is more infuriating. And I think there are people who, even now, we had our first head coach firing with Bill O'Brien this past week in Houston. And everybody says, oh, well, the GM who's in place came from the New England trees. They're likely to hire, you know, a Belichick disciple and be a Josh. And one of the issues I would say, Sid, and I say this all the time, is the majority of agents who represent coaches are white, tend to have white clients. And so those are the people in the media pushing the narratives and the hiring cycles. And I'd be curious to get, you know, you would probably see this on the CEO and the management side, you know, how headhunter firms, how they handle diversity. Who are the people? Who are the boards? Who are the headhunters that are making the decisions? Because that ultimately impacts the scope. And I think the same issues you see with NFL head coaches, I believe you see in Fortune 500 companies in terms of diversity. And the problem is the people making the decisions, usually their circles are not very diverse. And in the NFL, we need to improve that in a meaningful way. And to those collision points as coaches are rising up the ranks, to get owners and GMs more comfortable. But we have the problem with GMs too. I think there are only a handful right now of GMs who are more diverse. They're going to be more inclined to hire diverse head coaches, but we need more diverse GMs. And that pool, you know, grows. And the Rooney Rule is successful, but ultimately it only comes into play if you take it seriously. And look, when we did our head coaching search, we interviewed, I believe, 11 candidates. I believe 5 were diverse. Now we wound up hiring a 30-year-old white guy, which probably is about as far away from that. And Sean was an amazing hire. I think right now he sits only behind John Madden and Vince Lombardi in coaches winning percentage after 50 games. Truly a transcendent talent. And that was great in some regards, certainly great for the Rams. It has done a disservice, I think, to diverse coaching candidates in the fact that the in vogue thing became hiring a young 30-year-old offensive mind, of which the diverse candidate pool right now was not very strong.
Right, right.
Right. So we probably are guilty of taking it in the wrong direction. But I think the nice consequence of that is a focus from the NFL of, look, if that's where teams are going to hire from, and you see the success of a Matt LaFleur, you see Sean's success, then we need to do a better job of developing that pipeline for minorities. And if that's what comes from Sean's hire long term, it'll be a very good thing for the NFL. But right now, it has not been a great thing for diversity.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great perspective. And when you said, you know, there's been an emphasis on trying to find the next Sean McVay and somebody from the offensive side, and then you also said, well, we haven't been that good at hiring head coaches. I put those two together, and the number one thing I think of is Hollywood. And in Hollywood, you have a movie, and how do you know what to green light a movie? It's such a crapshoot in so many ways, and there's a very big failure rate. And the most likely thing to be supported is something that worked before. And so that's what you do. But it could be an ebb and a flow of the time in the league and the balance. And imagine every team had an offensive-oriented head coach. All of a sudden, it's not the same league anymore. There's going to be an advantage to having someone on the defensive side.
We learned from our mistakes, right? In 2012, we hired Jeff Fisher, who was the most coveted head coach on the market. There were 7 teams. Everybody wanted him. You know, we were fortunate to get him. And Jeff did some really good things for our organization to stabilize it from where we were prior to his arrival to post his arrival. Sean McVay does not have the success that Sean has without the work that Jeff Fisher did for 5 years. But at the same time, what it taught us was, to your point about Hollywood, just because you get the person that everybody wants to hire doesn't mean it's the right fit for you long term.
Yeah.
Right. And when we were hiring Sean McVay, One of the things, you know, and ultimately I give Stan Kroenke as the owner a ton of credit for signing off on hiring a 30-year-old. You know, here we were in LA and everybody expected us. You know, we made this move to Los Angeles in 2016, glamour franchise, big move, building a great new stadium, you know, in a very fickle marketplace. Everybody expected us to go hire a big name because that's what LA, that what Hollywood did. And Stan had the courage to say, you know, I really believe in Sean McVay. But one of the reasons we did was because we had done the big splashy hire that everybody wanted before. And for a multitude of reasons, it didn't work. And that told us that, you know, winning the press conference and making the big hire was not ultimately what was going to set us up for success. It was finding the right fit for our organization at that time. I think that is, you know, the one thing we struggle with right now. And I always find it very interesting when we talk about Hollywood head coaches. When you talk about hiring coaches, so many people talk about winning the press conference and doing something the fan base wants. And a lot of that, you know, gets back to what we were just talking about, whether it's coaching agents, the media, they all come up with a list, they do these things. And therefore, your fan base has been told by ESPN and NFL Network and Bleacher Report who you should hire and whether it's a good hire or not before they've even had a chance to come in. So winning the press conference now has become about winning the announcement before the press conference, then hoping, you know, the press conference goes well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the reasons people do that often is tied to the economics of my stadium's not full, my fans are upset, all of these elements. But when you look at the data on average, because I look at it every year at the NFL, they show, you know, in our meetings in May, the season ticket renewal rates of every team. And if you look at the teams that change coaches, they're always at the bottom. And renewing season tickets, you know, whether you hire the best name or the unknown name, is a challenge because it means the year before you were likely bad. So what happens is not that year, it's the following years ultimately of, is your coach going to have success? And that gets into the minority element of, because these names are not as well known, winning the press conference becomes less likely in an owner mind. And I would imagine it's similar to some degree, you know, on Wall Street in a public company, when you hire a new CEO, if you look at the stock price within a week, you know, do they like the announcement? Do they not like the announcement? Nobody would hire a CEO because they think it would help the stock price for a week. You do it because you ultimately hope over time your company grows, gets better, you know, and the CEO works. But yet, that's exactly what we do, at least in the NFL. I can't speak for the sports. We hire to try to get the stock price to jump for 1 week.
Right. I hadn't heard that expression about winning the press conference, but it's a great one. And it's also illogical, which makes it all the more interesting.
We all do it. And I am just as guilty as everybody else. We were fortunate. Sean McVay won the press conference.
Yeah. So you had a double win because the guy's good and he won the press conference.
But when we did it, we caught a lot of flack when we hired Sean. People could not believe that we had hired a 30-year-old. And then ultimately, you know, at each step along the way, he has proven correct. But I think it's also, to your point, looking for talent, you know, in different places than other people might and being willing to take those risks. But at the end of the day, it has to be a cultural fit for your organization. And you can either change your organization so that great talent is always a fit, or you can have an organization that's inflexible. And those tend not to succeed as much, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to ask you about COVID in a moment, but one final kind of quick point on this issue of hiring minority talent. What you've identified and have done with the Rams of having senior people, particular women, diverse people hire diverse people. So that's step number one. And that's not an easy thing to change because that means general managers have to be African-American and owners have to be African-American. And that's a big step given where we're at. But that's one idea. The other idea is to start to cultivate talent much, much earlier than anyone else. And that means players. You know, like in baseball, catchers have been a tremendous source of talent for baseball managers. I don't know what the equivalent might be, if there is, by position for football. It might not necessarily be a position, it might just be one-ofs, but to start to think about who has that interest. And those people self-identify in many ways because you see them. I'm sure, I mean, I haven't been in the locker room, but I'm sure that these are people that the coach or coaches will talk to, even if they're not 10-year veterans, because they just look at it a little bit different and they're thoughtful. That seems to be, you know, it's a long-term strategy, but that seems to be one avenue. What do you think about that?
Oh, I think it's huge. I mean, I think if you look at the success of Mike Vrabel right now in Tennessee, it's funny when you look at the Belichick tree, there's not been a ton of success coaching wise. But Mike Vrabel as a player has probably been the most successful of the Belichick tree. And so you're trying to understand, okay, what did he learn as a player from Bill Belichick as a linebacker that translated? I think there are a lot of positions where people who are making calls and adjustments. So, you know, it's easy to say quarterbacks, but I would say centers. Typically, the center might be your catcher in the NFL, safeties tend to see everything unfold in front of them and have to direct traffic. Middle linebackers who make the calls. Tight ends are interesting because they have to learn all the intricacies of the offense. So I think when you hear some of the candidates, you know, Dan Campbell's, people gravitate towards quarterbacks. I'm not sure that that is as much true. You know, I don't see that as much now. The irony, we always joke, Sean McVay was a quarterback in high school. He transitioned to a receiver at Miami, Ohio. He ran the option. He didn't throw the ball. And he actually was the Georgia State Player of the Year over Calvin Johnson, who's going to go to the Hall of Fame as a wide receiver. So probably not the best decision by the voters in Georgia. But I do think players, you know, it is cultivating talent. I think one of the things that you see across the board in baseball and basketball, and certainly right now in football, is there are so many more jobs in front offices for people to transition to. You know, be it player development, character development, scouting, coaching that come that way. And you're seeing many more players take that jump and that leap. You know, some are going to broadcasting, which is a natural evolution. But even from there, we're seeing more players get involved in scouting. And I think that then makes them a general manager, which forces them to hire coaches. But to me, and this gets into what people always talk about, and it's a little bit of the hybrid of, you know, the next Sean McVay. When people would ask me, well, what is the next Sean McVay? And I would say, like, you have to leave aside the offensive mind. He's a great play caller. But there are a lot of great play callers who don't necessarily become great head coaches. She's the best communicator and leader and cultural builder I've been around, you know, in anything. And so I think, you know, when you're looking, you know, in the NFL, were they a captain? Were they a leader? How long were they, you know, captain for? Are they those glue guys who guys in the locker room can relate to and lead? So I look at our team right now, you know, someone like an Andrew Whitworth, who's played a long time at a Pro Bowl level left tackle. He's the one guy when he speaks in our locker room, everyone listens and has kind of that glue mentality around him. I think you've hit it on the head. To get better and more diverse across the board, we need to identify those people and give them positions so they can start to grow into those roles. Look, you can't flood a pipeline a year into a focal point of, hey, we got to find a way to get minority coaches. That's not fair to the people who are you're looking at if you're not putting them in a position to succeed. What you have to say is, okay, 10 years from now, who are all the people we can put into the pipeline so that race is not a factor when you're hiring head coaches and they're equally suitable candidates on all sides of the ball. And even when you see that in college, you know, we get so much of our talent from a player perspective from college, but it's true. It ultimately comes up in coaching as well. And from that perspective, are we developing the right people and are we identifying and tapping them on the shoulder? The fact is these coaching staffs have grown from 15 people on average to, I think now we're at like 27. The average number of coaches in the NFL across the board, we should be able to find really talented people who are coming off of their playing days, who are coming from college playing days into these roles to grow and to get better. And if we're not looking in the right places to stock that talent. But I think one of the things, you know, that we also have to get better on the league, if we want to grow a more diverse pipeline, we have to be more patient with our head coaches. You know, if you're changing head coaches every 3 years and we're thinking so short term, we're incentivizing our head coaches to hire known quantities rather than to build an organization. If you're not getting the time to actually see a vision come to fruition, we are telling them, don't go invest in the young 23-year-old. Don't go invest in the first time coach. Take the most known quantities you can, because if we're going to decide on you in 2 years and your job is to win games quickly, they're going to take the shortcuts rather than the long-term view.
Yeah, that's a really excellent point, because you got to give people a chance to make things happen. 27 on average, let's say, I don't know if that's true, 25 to 30 managerial people running a team, the football operations. That's an easy metric that every team can or should publicize. How many are minority? How many are women, for that matter? Of course, the women will be smaller, but maybe it shouldn't be zero. It's on the way. Because it's one thing to say, well, there are not enough African-American head coaches, and there aren't. But when you have a talent pool of 25 or 30 people, and to say that there's zero or one or two, which I don't know what the numbers are, if there's a team that's very, very low, that seems to be a place that needs some attention.
Yeah, and The Athletic could be interesting. In early October, not knowing when the podcast will run, so I don't want to say last week, The Athletic did a study of every team and how many minority coaches they have throughout the ranks as a percentage of their group. And so it'd be good to go look at that. And I think as people identify that, you know, and look, even we have work to do. I mean, I think we have 9 or 10 minorities on our staff, but right now, none at the coordinator level. So we're just as guilty of trying to get better in doing that. Now we've hired a few people who I think, you know, over the next few years can, you know, transcend and grow into that role. But it is about making sure that you're filling the pipeline and looking in different places. And with that, we have to encourage people to do it. But I think the best thing we can do, if we really want to improve the minority pipeline, is we can be more patient with all of our coaches so that those coaches get a chance. You know, if someone takes a risk and hires someone new, the only way that works is if that person winds up having success. And if we're at the point now where these coaches are lasting 3 years and not having success, you have a ton of people, if they're coming in the league for the first time, won't last longer than 3 years. And they go back to college, they go elsewhere, and that's a struggle.
By the way, in Fortune 500 type companies, the average tenure is around 4 years of a CEO. And if you know that that's the average walking in, what are you going to do? You need a home run pretty quick. You can't just skate by. And so that creates even more volatility and greater risk taking. And sometimes there'll be some big wins, but very often there won't be. So COVID, there have been some cases from Tennessee in particular, but now several teams, and we're recording this in mid-October, and hopefully we'll be able to get it out before the month is done if we do the turnaround fast enough. One of the questions I also have is about the bubble. Did you, as a league, consider the bubble? Why didn't you do the bubble in the way that the NBA, which apparently has worked pretty well, and even the NHL for that matter, that used two cities for their entire playoffs?
You know, I think if you look at the bubble concept, I just think the sheer number of people in the NFL and the way the sport plays makes a bubble really hard.
It's a big bubble. It's a lot of people on each team.
Right. I mean, we're talking, and I was having this conversation with someone yesterday. We were talking, and just if we're at 25 to 30 coaches, the NBA bubble, I believe, in its entirety was 30 to 35 people per team. Mm-hmm. Right. That doesn't even get our coaches and equipment people. You know, we haven't even talked about a player yet once you're at 30 to 35. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, you get into this perspective of there is no singular place that could have housed. In the NFL, we have what we call a tier system. Tier one are players and player people who interact with players every day, coaches, equipment managers, trainers. I believe that number is 115 right now in the NFL. And then we have tier two, which are scouts and team presidents and media and everything else within our own world. It's about another 40 to 50. So you'd be talking a bubble of about 150 people per team. Right. So multiply that by 32. There is no singular place that could house all of those people. But then you get into some other weird things like where do you practice? In the NBA, you could set up basketball courts in a ballroom and teams practice for an hour. But all NFL teams practice on Wednesdays, Thursdays, Fridays, you know, in similar times. Can you find a place that has 32 fields that are quality enough to say, OK, Los Angeles Rams, you go to this high school. Cincinnati Bengals, you go here. New York Jets, you go here at the same time, right? Does that actually work? You have the cars, the infrastructure. So then you get into probably not, which means that, okay, then your other alternative would be to create a bubble within your own city. I think that was something the NFL discussed and dismissed is, okay, well, once you're in a hotel, you know, all of those people, then you're bringing in maintenance staff, food staff, housekeeping, you know, other people who are staying at the hotel. Do you block off the hotel? Do you not? You know, so the NFL went to a daily testing model instead, where everybody in tier one and tier two gets tested every day. A number of social distancing protocols. We built, for those who watch Hard Knocks, which are on, we built a massive outdoor tent where we now do all of our meetings, all of our player interactions so that nothing is done inside. The NFL wears contact tracing bracelets that beep if you get within 6 feet of each other. And at the end of each day, you upload those bracelets to a system on the cloud, and it says, okay, Sid Finkelstein and Kevin Damoff were within 6 feet for 4 minutes today.
Wow.
So if one of us gets test positive, they're okay because they weren't in proximity enough per CDC guidelines. We don't have to contact, trace, and isolate Kevin. We just know they were, but in this case, you know, so when you look at the Patriots, why they were able to play, you know, after Cam Newton did it, it's because their devices said that nobody was within 6 feet of Cam Newton for 10 minutes for that period. It shows that the Patriots clearly were doing things the right way, you know, once COVID got into their building. And so I think the NFL feels instead of a bubble, that's the case. And look, I think the other difference is baseball did not do a bubble, had early outbreaks with the Marlins and the Cardinals, you know, but ultimately after that got things sorted in the right way. The NFL, I think if you're playing a full season or an abbreviated season, it is much harder to keep people committed to the bubble. In the NBA and the NHL, you only had to stay in the bubble if you kept winning and you were advancing in the playoffs, right? That's a great incentive to stay in the bubble. Mm-hmm. Someone would have to explain to me, you know, if you're a team, and I don't want to pick on the New York Jets right now, but they are 0-4, or Houston Texans who just fired their head coach and are 0-4. If their season continues on the path they're on in mid-November and they're 3-8, 3-9, what is their incentive to stay in the bubble once they've been eliminated from the playoffs, once they're no longer in the race to do everything? Like,
sure,
these players are going to want to go home and see their families. Mm-hmm. It sounds great in theory in September and October. I think as you get later in the year, it probably doesn't work. I think the NFL has done an amazing job in creating a system to allow us to play. When you look at the sheer number of tests, you're coming up on 500,000 tests, maybe more, in which 20 or 30 have been positive. That is an amazing rate, well below, you know, the public. And it shows, you know, I think unfortunately for public health, when you have a ton of money and resources, what you can do to test and to trace, to do the things that will keep us healthy as a society. That being said, I think if you're going to play football and travel around the country and do these things in areas where, you know, COVID hotspots happen, you know, you're going to wind up inevitably with cases. And I think much like the rest of the world, we have to get to a point in the NFL where one case does not shut down the NFL and one case doesn't shut down the world. We're going to have to learn to live with those risk reward, you know, quotients. Right now, I mean, strangely enough, the biggest COVID hotspot in the United States right now is Green Bay, Wisconsin. That seems very odd, but per capita, Green Bay has the worst COVID numbers of any metropolitan area in the country. So right now, I mean, that means the Packers, who I think all of us would sit here and say, like, that seems like a place, you know, as we joked about Hanover, you know, maybe being, you know, less COVID. Like, Green Bay is not that different than the Upper Valley in terms of population. It's going to wind up in our facilities. And I would say right now, there's a lot of people who want to pile on to Tennessee for maybe not doing things the right way. The one thing you learn about COVID, it can happen to any of us, even under the best precautions. And you just have to adapt and adjust. And I think the one thing we talked about as a football team, as an organization, is this year is going to be different. It's going to be strange. And we have to understand that our starting quarterback may miss 3 weeks because of COVID. Does that mean there's an asterisk by whoever wins, you know, a title in the NFL? Yes, there probably is an asterisk unless the Rams win the Super Bowl, in which case there's not an asterisk.
It's perfectly fine, of course.
It's fine and reasonable. But I think it gets back to the point of, you know, we're an entertainment product, and to try to entertain, we have to do the best we can. It's not going to be perfect. Some games are going to get moved around. Some players aren't going to be able to play. The most important thing is keeping our players and staff healthy. And as long as we can do that, you know, we're going to have to tolerate some outbreaks at some levels.
Yeah. One last question. And it's a question I like to ask everyone on the Sidcast about advice, but it's advice to yourself. So if you can go back in time to the 21-year-old Kevin, maybe listening in on Dad Marvin's negotiations, but the 21-year-old Kevin, and you were able to go back in time and sit next to him, what would you say? You lean over to him and say, if there's one thing you want to do or not do, or there's something you want to know about the world, or if there's one bit of advice I have for you, what would that be? Advice for yourself.
I've been extremely fortunate, and most choices I've made have worked out in seemingly half. I think the advice, though, for myself is don't be afraid of risky choices. You know, there is no linear path to success or happiness anywhere in the world. And when the jobs that seem the worst are probably the best opportunities. You know, and even I was listening to a podcast yesterday talking about similar about minority coaches. Mm-hmm. And one of the things was, you know, don't take a bad job because you might get fired. And I think quite opposite. I think the advice to myself, take the bad jobs because it's where you can have the greatest impact and change. When I got hired at the Rams, and it was a hard decision to stay in Tampa or come to, it was a franchise that was coming off of two of the worst seasons in franchise history. It was in a smaller market that had a lease issue. The owner had just died. The team was about to be put up for sale. The only reason I was hired was because I was inexpensive and fungible for the next owner, and likely was going to be fired when that person came in and took over. Probably if I were to look back, you know, on all the reasons, pro, con, I shouldn't have taken the job because people said it would be a job, you know, career killer. And it wound up being the exact opposite. So I think the advice I always have, the things that seem riskiest are, you know, that way. And the advice, it's funny you pick 21-year-old Kevin. 20-year-old Kevin, who met my wife in Hanover as a sophomore at Dartmouth, she was, you know, the first person I dated who I was kind of like, I don't think this is going to go anywhere necessarily, but, you know, and here we are. January will be 24 years since we started dating at Dartmouth. You know, the things that you have the least expectations or the biggest risks, I think, are the greatest opportunities. You know, and I laugh, right? 21-year-old Kevin was never planning to go to business school. When I was a senior at Dartmouth, I coached sixth grade basketball team in Hanover Elementary. And our star player was Jackson Womack.
Yeah.
Dad Kent was, yes, you know, a top professor. And I remember at the end, and Jackson was an amazing, he was 6 foot in sixth grade, tall, and but was the gentle giant. And, you know, our job was to try to make him a player. And I remember at the end, Ken, who unfortunately passed away, you know, said, hey, if you ever have interest in applying to business school, let me know. I'd be happy to help. And I'm like, yeah, I'm never going to business school. That seems like the dumbest thing to do in life. And 5 years later, I picked up the phone and called and said, hey, you know, I'm actually considering doing this. And then it was the best decision I ever made. So what you think at 21 your life is going to be is not actually the case. You're going to take many twists and turns. You know, you're going to take a bunch of jobs that may challenge you in different ways, but we all grow most when we're challenged. And everybody wants the stair step up, promotion to the next step, make a little bit more money, do the logical thing. And I don't think success works that way. So I always tell people, be willing to take the big detour, be willing to move anywhere, do anything, take the opportunities you can, especially when you're young and you don't have a family. Mm-hmm. You know, the choices you make in your 40s when you have kids and are different than the ones you can make in your 20s. So my advice to 21-year-old Kevin would be embrace going to business school. It will change your life. Embrace moving to the middle of the country and taking on, you know, a job that seems hard. But to everybody who's, you know, we all have plans. We all have dreams. They don't happen the way you think they're going to happen. You know, we always talk about enjoying the journey and not just about the, you know, being about the destination. And I think, you know, that is never more true, you know, than right now as we try to find silver linings in COVID and everything else is find the place where you are going to be happiest, but it's not necessarily what you imagine you will be. And I hate to talk about other schools, you know, being a Dartmouth grad and a Tuck MBA, but, you know, I spent the last year listening to the podcast, The Happiness Lab out of Yale. And, you know, the whole premise is that what your brain tells you will make you happy doesn't actually make you happy. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something, you know, to understand. I recommend it to anybody who gets frustrated with things aren't going their way. You know, maybe rewire your brain, you know, to what will truly bring you happiness, because it's not always what you assume will.
Yeah. And, you know, what I really like about this story you're sharing is that there's some assumption that a 21-year-old could actually predict what a job is going to be like, is going to know what that industry is like, is going to know what that career. You don't even know that when you're 45. How are you going to really know it when you're 21? But somehow we think we could.
Someone's always said, oh, you know, and I was fortunate enough to grow up in Los Angeles. You know, if someone said, hey, 21-year-old Kevin, is your dream job to run the Los Angeles Rams? There is no NFL team in Los Angeles. It's not happening. There's no stadium. Right to your point, what the world is going to look like 10 years, 20 years from now is going to be vastly different. And if you don't embrace that, you're probably going to miss out on the greatest of opportunities. And, you know, when I was graduating from college, I went to work for a great internet boom bust company. I was the 30th person in. 9 months later, when I left, there were 300. And it was the number two IPO on Wall Street behind Krispy Kreme. 9 months later, they were out of business. My 100,000 shares right now are worth less than that Expos hat behind you. Right? So,
but there's, you know, sentimental value to that Expos cap, I'll tell you that.
Absolutely. So, you know, when you stop to think about what the world looks like, it's going to vastly change.
Kevin Demoff, what a great conversation. I feel like we could go another hour. We've gone far past 1 hour, in fact, but it's been really, really interesting. Thank you. Thanks so much for being on the Sidcast. Good luck this season, keeping COVID free, and good luck to the Rams. I wouldn't mind seeing the Rams in the Super Bowl again, maybe even against the Patriots, although that seems to be a lot less likely.
I would take right now the Rams in the Super Bowl against anybody. I do think there will be a nice chip on all of our shoulders if we got to see the Patriots again.
Kevin, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Sidcast. I am really excited to be bringing you season 2 and very appreciative that you've chosen to listen to this episode. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the series so you'll never miss a single new episode. I welcome all feedback and would love to hear from you. If you have any questions, suggestions for guests, or any suggestions at all, please contact me via our website, www.thesidcast.com. Or you could email me directly at sidfinkelstein@gmail.com. If you like what you heard, I hope you'll tune into another one of our episodes. And please give us a 5-star review and share with others who you think would enjoy and benefit from the show as well. The Sidcast is produced by the podcast Laundry Company. See you next time.